Hi, this is Justin Coletti of Sonic Scoop. Thanks for joining me for this week's episode of the Sonic Scoop podcast. And today, we're going to be talking about something that comes up a lot when people talk about music, and that is talent. Do you need talent to succeed in music? How much talent do you need to succeed in music? How do you know if you have enough talent to succeed in music? That's whether you're looking to play, to write, to sing, or to do what I do, audio engineering. I work as a mastering engineer. If you want to produce, if you want to record, how much does talent, musical talent, play a role in success? And you hear all sorts of perspectives on this. I mean, some people sometimes will say, talent is so important. If you're going to make music, you've got to have the talent for it. But then people will complain about some of their least favorite big hit musicians and talk about how untalented they are and how they're successful. So there is a knock and, you know, against needing talent to do well in music. So we did an episode last week called something along the lines of, how do you know if you're good enough to keep on doing this? Or how do you know if your mixes are good enough? How do you know if you're good enough to keep on doing music? And I got some great comments. A lot of people told me this was their favorite episode of the podcast I've ever done. And I think it's my favorite episode of the podcast I've ever done. But I want to go a little deeper into the specific question of talent that one of our readers, listeners brought up on the YouTube version of this podcast. A guy named Mage Prometheus wrote in to say, only about 1 in 10 people who aren't good enough to make music a career understand that they are missing key gifts that are often impossible to learn. So he says only 1 in 10 people who aren't good enough understand that they're missing key gifts that are impossible to learn. The other 9 in 10 are sucked into the misconception that anything can be learned with enough effort. He says, I know many music teachers who accept students who are never going to be decent musicians as just part of the job. Music has always been my hobby because I knew I was missing that last 10%, although I could enviously feel it in others. Do you have the inner strength, he asks, to tell someone when you know they haven't got what it takes? Man, I think that that line of thinking resonates with a lot of people. And I wrote a fairly lengthy reply to Mage Prometheus because I'm a total dork and I respond to my own YouTube comments. And that reply I wrote to him that tried to contextualize this stuff a little further, it got more likes than the average on this stuff. And even Mage Prometheus, this guy who, even though I gave him a little bit of pushback, seemed to like it as well. He says, love your point of view. Thanks. So I'm going to try to give you my point of view and give it a little bit longer than what I was able to do in a YouTube comment. And also, get it out hopefully to more people, because I think if you can understand with more nuance the role talent actually does and doesn't play in succeeding in music, that you're going to have a better go of things if you want to try to succeed in music. And you can actually find ways to circumvent the need for talent in many areas. We'll talk a little bit about that. And often, and also, if you don't decide to go into a professional career in music, I think you can even have a healthier and less envious approach to this question of talent if you think you're missing talent in certain areas. Now, I'm trying to do these podcasts a little bit more natural than the past. I'm trying to do no edits, so if I do some long pauses, it's because I'm stopping to think and make sure that I'm trying to get this to you as best as I can. Bear with me. I'm going to try to be as clean and tight as I can with that thing where I'm trying to do basically zero edits and just give you me. All right? First thing I want to tell you is that I am really informed, and my perspective has really changed on this issue by a fantastic book called Talent is Overrated. I really recommend that book on this subject. There's other books that explore this as well, but that's one in particular that I like a lot. And it also focuses a little bit on the whole 10,000 hours to mastery idea, but it goes so much deeper. People know Malcolm Gladwell for popularizing the 10,000 hours to mastery kind of idea. I believe he talked about in a book called Outliers, drawn on the work of a professional, I forget if he's a research psychologist, but a research scientist, a guy by the name of Erickson, I believe is his last name, who did all this research suggesting that 10,000 hours and you can get to mastery in most fields. And that's actually not completely true, because there's some fields where there's less competition where you can become a master of that field with way less than 10,000 hours because so few people are doing it. And the bar to become a master in that field is relatively low. Like if you were trying to become among the world's best in like balancing a broomstick on your nose or, you know, a pencil on your nose or something, you could probably get to be one of the best in the world at it with far fewer than 10,000 hours of mastery. However, with concert pianists, where so many people throughout history have tried to become the best in the world at, it actually takes more than 10,000 hours. So there is, though, this reality that practice is big. And practice is probably the biggest thing in becoming a good performer. But I don't want to totally write off the idea of talent. But I also don't want to say that without talent, you're stuck and you're not going to succeed, because there are tremendous workarounds for talent. And you see them constantly in the world that we live in, and in some of the music that you love, and maybe in some of the music that you hate. And I want to explore that with you. And I want to get you to figure out how to make the most out of the talents that you have, and where you don't have talents, completely sidestep them so that they're irrelevant. But I also don't want to lie to you, and I don't want to tell you that there are no areas where talent is big in music, because in some areas it might be. So how do we balance these ideas? Practice and dedication, hard work versus talent. Because it is a balancing act. That's what we're going to be talking about today. And I'm going to give you some concrete ideas. Before we get into it, I do always do the brief sponsor shout-out section. So here it is. Big thanks this week to Focusrite. I'm speaking to a lovely Focusrite Claret interface right now. They're sponsoring again once this month. Hasn't given me a lick of trouble. Great sounding interface. Really just clean gain. They make awesome bang for the buck stuff from their really cheap Scarlett line, one of the most popular interface lines ever made in the history of interfaces, all the way up to their high-end Red series. They're making really great stuff. Also, big thanks to Soundtoys, one of my favorite makers of software effects. Been sponsoring this podcast from the beginning. Good friends of mine. They make literally, if you haven't tried the Soundtoy stuff, some of the best stuff out there. So go to soundtoys.com, try out anything they make for free. Now back to talent, the idea of talent in music. How do we decide what's more important, the talent or the hard work? And I've had people push back against this idea of, hey, if you spend enough time practicing, you can get great. And there's one study that a friend of mine sent me a while back when I was first writing about this idea of talent versus hard work and how much each plays a role. And the study went something like this. He said, aha, I'm going to show you, Justin, that talent matters more than you're giving it credit for. It's more than this 10,000 hour stuff. Because there was this study where they took a bunch of piano players and they found that in a group of people who practiced a ton and they all practiced the same amount and they all hit the, I forget the number, the 15,000 hours or this number of hours a week, that this group of people who all practiced the most, there was still a variation in how good they were considered when you had this panel of expert music listeners listening to each of them play piano, and there were some people who performed 10% better than others and they all practiced the same amount. So talent is big. And when you get to all of the people practicing the most at piano, that 10% is going to separate you from getting the gig as the concert pianist or not getting it. So, aha, it matters. And I don't want to say completely no, but I want to say that to come to that conclusion, you have to leave a lot out. Because in that very same study, they didn't just test groups of people who practice piano all the time. They also had a group of people who practice it considerably less. And these people practice considerably less, still practice a lot, and they were still really accomplished piano players. And if you or I heard them, you'd say, oh, that person knows how to play piano. But they practice considerably less, and they put them into a couple of different tiers, right? And the people who practice considerably less compared to the people who practice the most, like across the board, the same panel of experts said the people who practice the most sounded like 50% better, whatever it was, than the people who practiced the least. So we're taking a group, all people who know how to play piano well, and the people who practice the most sound enormously better than the people who practice the least within a group of people who all know how to play piano pretty well. But then you take just the top strata, like the top 10% of that group of people all knew how to play piano really well. And then within that group, they're getting different scores, even though they basically all practice the same amount. And the variation is relatively small. Instead of 50% or 100%, 10% variation. Now, talent could be the thing that's separating the very best person in that tiny, tiny upper echelon from the other people in that tiny, tiny upper echelon. And maybe that does make a difference if you're trying to get the piano job playing for the New York Philharmonic. And maybe if you're number two, you don't get the piano job playing the New York Philharmonic. Maybe if you're number two, you go to the Chicago Symphony Orchestra or something. No, not mean to bash on Chicago here, but you get the idea. And if you're the third best person, maybe you're in some orchestra in Pennsylvania. I don't know. I don't know enough of which orchestras are still around and relevant to rank them. I apologize for that. But yes, if you are not the top of the top 1% of piano players, you're probably not going to get a gig with any of the symphony orchestras. But that doesn't mean you can't make a living making piano. And I can tell you right now that Billy Joel, who likes playing piano a lot, and he plays classical piano, famous songwriter, particularly successful in the 1980s, for those of you who don't know him, he's like a multi-millionaire. I wouldn't be surprised if he's, you know, like a deca or 100 millionaire. I don't know. I haven't looked at Billy Joel's net worth. But he's probably made more money than any of the much better piano players. He's a good piano player. He's probably made more money than any of these piano players, so much better than him. He'd never be able to beat them for the gig playing at, you know, Carnegie Hall every other night of the week. And yet he's making more than a huge living playing piano. And if you like Billy Joel's songwriting, maybe you do, maybe you don't. I've gone back and forth. When I was a teenager, I hated his stuff. Now I hear his stuff now and I'm like, oh, there's some good stuff in there. Oh my goodness. I feel like a dork for admitting it. I'm like dad age now. So now I like Billy Joel. Oh my God. He's a talented songwriter. There's no denying it. Or should I say he's a great songwriter in his niche. There's, I think, no denying that he's good at it, whether that comes from talent or practice. And we'll discover that more. So he sidestepped his, did he have a lack of talent in becoming a great pianist? Or could he have become a super great one if he had, you know, and he's, by all accounts, a good piano player. He can play classical pieces very well. Could he have become an even greater one if he had talent in that area, or if he had worked harder in that area? But he sidestepped that whole question altogether of whether or not I need to have the finger speed and the sight reading ability and all that, and he made success somewhere else. Billy Joel is an example that might not resonate with a lot of people. Let's go to the other end of the spectrum. Biz Markie. Great rapper, great MC in my humble opinion, but is he like the fastest, the most brilliant, the most adept? No, but he is the most charmingly Biz Markie, right? And that's what got people into Biz Markie. He was the best Biz Markie you can be. The last episode of the podcast I went into, I threw out a couple of names, you know, of Bob Dylan. Bob Dylan isn't a great singer. Could he hack it in opera? And this is actually, I'll read you some of the comment I responded to Mage Prometheus with. And I'll just read through this real quick, and then I'll go into some other ideas we haven't touched on. I wrote back to Mage. I said, I think you touched on something really important here. And I tried to address it a little bit in the past episode. I think that if you're in a field where the path to success is to be virtuosic in a narrowly predefined way, then yes, talent becomes an even bigger component of your success. Hard work might get you 90% of the way there in those fields. But to get to the top 10%, or even the top 1% or 2% of people who make a go of it in that kind of world where you're supposed to be successful in this narrowly defined virtuosic way, then maybe some type of natural talent or aptitude is going to put you over the top. I really don't know. But that's not most people making a living in music. In popular music and so many other musical realms, you can be untalented in a lot of areas and just work around them and focus on where you might be more naturally, I don't even know if it's natural, but more naturally good instead. For instance, Bob Dylan is no singer, and yet he is a singer. Could he make it an opera if he tried really, 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 really hard? Probably not. But he doesn't have to make it an opera. Neither does Tom Waits or Neil Young or Jay-Z, right? The same kind of thing can even be true in jazz, although a lot of jazz these days is driven by being virtuosic within a somewhat narrowly defined set of parameters. There are always people reinventing styles and making that kind of virtuosic success in a narrowly defined way irrelevant. Was Thelonious Monk the best piano player? For those of you who don't know Thelonious Monk, like stop, listen to some Thelonious Monk. Right now, he's one of the most absurd piano players ever and brilliant in his own way. So was he the best piano player? Absolutely not. Like, no one is going to argue that Thelonious Monk was the best, most adept piano player. If you put sheet music in front of him and asked him to play some, you know, Beethoven piano concerto better than everyone else, probably wasn't going to do it. But he was the most Thelonious Monkey sounding piano player to have ever lived. He was better than anyone else at sounding like Thelonious Monk, and so he was successful. And this works even more so when you get out of academic music styles. But unfortunately, some of us can make even non-academic music styles where we have all this freedom more academic by simply trying to repeat what others do instead of finding where we can be uniquely successful and going down that path. Instead of trying to beat the most naturally talented, the most Aspergerly dedicated to practice. And instead of trying to beat them at that game, if that's not the game that we can win at, then just sidestepping it and playing our own game. So if being a professional is the goal, this is the end of the comment I wrote, if being a professional is the goal, then beating others at their game is a very, very difficult path that only the insanely talented can win. That's probably true. But if we can create our own game around our own strengths and weaknesses, then almost no one in the world can beat us at it. And I think that is what most of our favorite artists do. And I want you to tell me in the comments below or shoot me an email at podcast@sonicscoop.com if you prefer that. Tell me about artists who you love, who you know are incredibly untalented in a key area where you'd expect them to be talented in order to succeed at music. And tell me how they sidestepped it, what they were able to do instead, and why they made being untalented or just lazy in one area, how they made that work for them. I'd love to hear your examples. Tell me about your favorite untalented or lazy in a certain area artists and why they were great despite that. And I'd love to hear about it in the comments below or podcast@sonicscoop.com. And sometimes to make this stuff click even more, we've got to step back from music to really gain a perspective on it that's going to allow us to come back into the music world where all of our emotions are tied up and really get the emotional distance we need to look at this. So I'm going to give you a couple of other examples outside of music. And I'm going to use physical attributes for a second. And one of the most genetically determined physical attributes is height. Probably even much more so than that is hair color and eye color. But even hair color and stuff like that is not completely genetically determined. It can change with time. It can change with hormones. There are species, like you take some Arctic hares, and they're white during the winter and then brown during the spring, right? So their fur color changes based on the hormonal milieu that's going on, right? Based on how sunny it is or how warm it is. And you might meet some kids, or you might be one of them, who's blonde when they were young and then their hair got darker with age, or the opposite can happen. Or for a lot of us, the hair could go white with age. So there's epigenetic factors. It's not just the genes we have, but which ones are activated, turned on and turned off. And that's hugely important. Even in something that's one of the most genetically determined physical attributes, like height, there is extreme variation in the same person potentially within it. So you might say to yourself, well, I don't have the genetics to be the tallest guy around. And that's true for probably 50% of guys, right? 50% of guys are going to be shorter than average, right? That's how like math works. But if that's something that bugs you, right? I am not going to be the tallest guy around. But when you're growing up, if you have genetics of not the tallest guy around, if you're really, really malnourished, you could end up being 5'1" with a top hat on, right? Or you could end up being maybe 5'10" if everything goes right in the acquiring height department that's important to you. So this person who winds up at 5'5" or 5'6" or 5'7" or 5'8", who's, you know, what's the average height in America is like 5'9", 5'10", like something like that. So someone who's below that, there's a whole range of heights they could have wound up. Maybe 5'1"-ish if everything went wrong, maybe 5'10"-ish if everything went right. So within that variation, there's a huge, huge range. And the same thing could be true for people who are insanely tall. You know, the guy who turned out to be 7 feet, he might have only turned out to be 6'5" if things went differently, right? Or, you know, or if he didn't get enough calories to turn out to be 6'5", maybe he'd be dead of malnourishment, right? So there's a whole bunch of factors here. So even things that do have a really major genetic component are not fully genetic. And are you going to tell me that talent is more genetic than hair color or height? Because I don't think that it is. And also factors can be irrelevant. You'd think that height would be really, really important in basketball because, I mean, most of the people who get picked to play basketball are really, really tall. And if I remember correctly, there's some absurd statistic. Like if you look at all of the guys who are 7 feet tall in America right now, like 20% of them currently play for the NBA. So it's an advantage, right? In playing basketball. It might be slightly off in those exact numbers, but something close to that. Someone knows the exact statistic. They can put it down below. But that doesn't explain Muggsy Bogues, who's one of my favorite basketball players of all time because he's one of the weirdest. I like weird things. Muggsy Bogues, I think he was, I don't know if he's 5'4", 5'5", but he was like, go look up, just YouTube, like Muggsy Bogues highlights. How do you spell his name? Muggsy Bogues, I think is maybe that. Muggsy Bogues, he played in the Chicago Bulls back when I had a very fleeting interest in basketball in the 90s. I never got good at basketball because my interest in it was very fleeting. But Muggsy Bogues, he came up to like practically the waists of some of these super tall basketball players. But watching him, especially if you watch some highlight reels where he's throwing a ball halfway across the court, catching it, like running circles around people, and like an amazing athlete who focus on things like hard work and speed and the way that he played defense. An amazing, even if you're not interested in basketball, which I'm not really interested in basketball that much, you show me a Muggsy Bogues highlight reel. I'm like, whoa, that's crazy. That person's doing that. So was that all hard work, that he worked harder than so many other guys who didn't make it into the NBA who were 6'7"? Because I'm sure there's a ton of, for the one Muggsy Bogues that there is, there's probably a ton of guys who are like 6'5", 6'6", who are like, God damn it, I'm not in the NBA. I always wanted to be, and that guy is. But he made it work. Was it all hard work? Maybe. He probably worked really, really hard. But did he also maybe focus on his talents instead of someone else's talents? Muggsy Bogues probably didn't try to spend a lot of his time winning slam dunk competitions, right? That would be a foolish place to put his energy. So he put his energy in other places where he could be insanely effective. So kind of knowing where his natural strengths were, if talent is a thing, your biggest talent is in recognizing where your talents are. And I got to tell you, out of those top 1% or 2% or 5% or 10% or whatever people who get the greatest concert pianist job in the country, their playing ability might not have been the only thing that landed in that gig. Because maybe there was someone else who played slightly better, or it's so subjective, you know, they're roughly in the same category. But one was easier to get along with. One was better at taking direction. One played better with others. One was just funnier and cracked more jokes. Whatever it is, one of them was more disciplined. One of them had a better aptitude for travel, and travel is a big portion of the gig. So even when you're there competing at the tip top, there are other factors besides the raw talent and the one thing that you think is important that gets you the gig. Because you don't just have one talent. You have many talents. You have like a melange of talents, a unique blend of talents that's totally unique to you and different from everyone else in their exact proportions and their exact development. I look at the word talent and I think of latent potential. That's what talent means to me. It means aptitude. It means potential ability. Talent isn't actually ability that you have. It's the potential for gaining ability. And you don't have talents in one area, and your success in music or anything else is not dictated by your specific talents in one narrow area. And I think that's insanely important to realize. People who listen to this podcast a lot know that I do jiu-jitsu and judo. They're kind of combat sports. They're kind of fun. I don't actually watch a lot of MMA, mixed martial arts. Too bloody for me. I don't like all the punching. Although, if you give me some old school boxing, I mean, boxing can be really interesting. But I wouldn't want to watch it around my 2.5-year-old daughter. It's too violent, right? And some of the like most severe MMA, not a big fan of all the punching and the blood. Maybe I'm squeamish. I'm too gentlemanly. I just like to choke people until they tap me and threaten to break their arms. That's so much more gentlemanly than punching somebody. But if you watch the early mixed martial arts, early things like the early Ultimate Fighting Championship, UFC, or the Vale Tudo Japan, really interesting stuff, where there were no rules yet, and they were figuring out what the rules should be. There were like no rounds, no weight classes. You'd have matches where some 250-pound guy was fighting some 135-pound guy. And this happened. The Vale Tudo Japan, you can watch a documentary about a great jiu-jitsu practitioner and mixed martial arts fighter named Hickson Gracie. And in this documentary about him called Choke, You can watch the person who came in second place after Hicks and Gracie, who was the world champion in that particular vein. The guy who came in right behind him, I think he was like 5'6" and 135 pounds. And I think two of his matches right before Hicks and Gracie were guys who were over 6 feet tall and over 200 pounds. And he beat them. He didn't beat them by going toe-to-toe and trading punches with them, Mike Tyson style. He had other tricks and other approaches that allowed him to defeat these people. And one of them was so frustrated that he was getting beaten by this guy who, like, you know, came up to his nipples that he gouged him in the eyes and permanently blinded him in one eye because he was so frustrated about this little guy beating him. And the thing is, he didn't play the same game that the people much bigger than him were playing. He played a different game. And that's changed today. If you watch mixed martial arts or UFC or something today, which is quickly starting to become like the new boxing, like it's really, you know, it's known, but it's been known for a while, but it's starting to get to that level where it's like the type of combat sport that people watch. And, you know, once an older generation is gone, it'll probably be the dominant combat sport left. But today it's very different, and weight classes really start to matter. And everyone's playing the same game. They know how long the rounds are. They know exactly what the parameters are. We're going to be in this kind of ring, with this kind of gloves, with these kind of rules. And so many people now train for this one precise rule set that all of a sudden some of those natural talents and aptitudes become more and more important. And could a smaller person still be a bigger person with hard work and training? Absolutely. But it becomes significantly more difficult because everyone's playing the same game. But that doesn't exist in music. Outside of a few narrowly defined sports or games that we play, that doesn't really exist in the world. And in our world, in the world of music and audio production, it's not necessarily about finding a game that other people have mastered and trying to be even better than them at it. You can do that, and some people do succeed that way. It's not just about copying other people and falling short of them. If you're going to do things really, really well, and you're going to be at the top, it's most likely because you created a new game that no one can beat you at, where you're going to be at the top, because you've got to decide what the musical game is that you're playing. And no one can play it better than you. Who can James Brown better than James Brown? Nobody. Nobody. And anyone who tries to James Brown better than James Brown is going to be copying James Brown. They're going to fall short of James Brown. Who knows? Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe there's someone who can take everything that James Brown did and work harder than the hardest working men in show business, mind you, and do even better than James Brown to James Brown's own game. Maybe that's possible. Maybe there'll be one guy who's the new champion of James Browning. I doubt it. But that's going to be a very, very small swath of who can be successful. And here's the other thing. You don't even need to pick a game where you're the best in the world and everyone recognizes you. I mean, as successful as Tom Waits is, he's probably much less of a household name than James Brown. He invented his own game and was successful there. But as successful as Tom Waits was, there are so many smaller indie artists who I could mention that it would be irrelevant for me to mention because you might not have even heard of them, but they made a successful, sustainable, long-term career for themselves in music or music production. Or maybe they're not indie artists. Maybe they're people who do scoring for films, for TV shows, for commercials, royalty-free music, who are finding their niche in that. Or children's music, or whatever it is, who are finding those niches in that area. And the same is true if you want to be a mixer, a producer, or someone who records. I mean, what's the speciality? What's the niche that you can carve out for yourself? Is it niche or niche? You tell me in the comments below. Let me know what you think. So you got to make up your own game. And you can make up a game that speaks to your unique set of talents, aptitudes, and interests. Because the biggest part is not just the talent, the latent raw potential, but the development of those talents. And the development of those talents into something requires the hard work and the practice and the dedication. And I'll tell you what, talent can be an obstacle. Some people are talented at music and it comes to them naturally. They start learning something and it's so easy that they never develop good practice habits so that when it becomes hard, they don't have the tools to get through it. This was a problem for me in many areas. I picked up a lot of stuff pretty quickly in music and I take standardized tests well. But because both of those things were happening, I never developed good homework and study habits when I was young, and that probably held me back from academic success because I would just test well naturally. But I wouldn't put in the work so that when I kind of got out into the working world at first, I didn't have the practiced and study habits and discipline that would have made me more successful sooner in some areas. And because I picked up things fairly well on musical instruments, when I started struggling, I didn't have the patience or the capacity to deal with it. And that kind of made me plateau. And there's a lot of people in music who I know feel that way. There's a movie called Five Easy Pieces with Jack Nicholson. And it's called that because there's this one seminal moment in it where Jack Nicholson's character was like supposed to be this great piano player, but he didn't really do anything with it. And his parents or whoever it was saying to him, why don't you, like, what happened to you and your piano playing? Like, you're so good at this and you're just not applying yourself. And he said, I was never that good. I just learned the five easiest pieces I could to be able to show off and impress people and fool them into thinking I was good. I put enough work into those five easy pieces that, well, it's almost like a parlor trick. I don't have the capability to be a great piano player. I don't have the interest to be a great piano player. It was basically his character's comments. And that movie is tied to that idea of him discovering himself and or going down the path he went down because of his maybe frustrations with identity. I don't know if it's an amazing movie that you have to watch, even though some people will say that about it, but I think that's a good core concept from it. That frustration we feel when the actual things we want to do are separate from our identity that we've made for ourselves. And you've got to get that mismatch not happy. Like, you don't want that to be mismatched. The things you like to do every day and your identity, you should get those as close together as possible. So that you don't have this identity over here of music maker, but the thing you have over here is I don't like to make music. Or you have this identity of guitarist, but you don't actually like to play guitar that often. You have to find the things you do like doing all the time. And for me, as much as I like playing piano, playing musical instruments, I loved playing in bands, I loved that thing, I didn't really have the interest in sitting down and woodshedding on a particular instrument. But I could sit down and woodshed on audio and just go over the same audio problems again and again and again. Like, I was attracted to doing that work again and again and again. So did I have more of a talent for audio than for music, and that's why I wound up in audio? I don't know if it was talent. I don't know that it necessarily came easier for me to do audio. But it was a puzzle that I was excited to sit down again and again and again and do. I want to wrap this up. So the last quick thing I'll give you about this is a scene that annoys me from the movie, I think it was Mr. Holland's Opus, where he's teaching this little girl to play clarinet. And she shows up diligently for all of her lessons, and she practices as much as possible, and she practices as much as any of the other kids, and she just can't make the clarinet sound any good. And he says to her, oh, you know, don't worry, it's still good that you tried, and that's the big thing. And it's like, I watched that scene, I'm like, no! No one, unless they actually have a defect, like mentally or physically, can play clarinet the amount of time you'd need to get good at clarinet and not get at least passingly good at it. What actually happens in those situations is that kids don't practice as much as they think they're going to do. They lie about it. They're not really practicing, and that's why they're not good. They might feel like they practiced a lot because the fact that they put in 5 minutes of practice into this thing that they hate felt like forever. So when they're telling the story of how much they practice, it feels true to them because it feels like they practiced forever because they hated it. But if you actually look at the timer, they didn't practice forever. They sat at the bench and struggled with, I don't want to practice and all this, and they don't practice. Is that because they don't have talent and it doesn't come to them as quickly so they get more frustrated? Maybe. I don't think that is always the case or even is the case. I think what's more likely to be the case is it's just not that interesting to them because there's other things that interest them more that they'd rather be doing. Now, that might not be the only component. There might be a talent or aptitude or how quickly something comes to you component. But I know people who've succeeded in things that didn't come quickly to them. And I know people, very smart people, said, why am I struggling with things that come so hard to me that I'm working so hard at? Why don't I go to something that's a little easier that I don't have to struggle as hard at? But at the end of the day, the thing that's going to make it feel like not a struggle is that you enjoy doing it and you enjoy learning the puzzle. And you'd almost do better to go into something that you don't have a natural aptitude at, but you're fascinated by the puzzle, than to something where you do have a natural aptitude and you're not fascinated by the puzzle. Because that's the thing, doing it again and again. And finding your own path and creating your own game instead of trying to beat other people at their game. So let me know down in the comments below if you want to, what are some of the things that you could be focusing on that are great talents of yours where you could put more of your energy, or just areas of great interest for you where you could place more of your energies and be okay with that? And what are some areas where maybe you feel like you don't have the talent or the aptitude or the interest to get really good in it that other people think that you should get good at, but you can say, you know what? I don't have to get good at that area. I can outsource that area, or I can compensate for that area with these other areas. And that's a great way to think when you're planning out what you're going to do with your life, how you're going to become a success in the areas you want to be successful in. As always, I hope this episode of the Sonic Scoop podcast was useful for you. Big shout out to our sponsors, Focusrite, for sending this lovely Focusrite Clarity interface. Check them out, focusrite.com. They make just astoundingly good bang for the buck stuff and really nice high-end stuff as well. Also, SoundToys, some of my favorite software effects. Check out anything they make for free at soundtoys.com. And also, please, you can sponsor this podcast by smashing the like button if you haven't already, and by hitting subscribe, and commenting below. All that stuff really helps. Share this with your friends if you think it was useful. That's the other thing. You're the newsstand of today. If you want to get better, more useful news and ideas out there, you got to be active in sharing this stuff. So if you can share this with your friends, I really appreciate it. And if you really like the podcast version, you're on the audio-only versions, if you could give this a 5-star rating and review on iTunes or wherever else you listen to your podcast, it really helps more people get to hear messages like this one. If you want even more with me, I got some free workshops for you. You can get the 5 Habits of Truly Great Mixers, where I go over the common threads I found in the stories of all of the best mixing engineers out there. You can get that at sonicscoop.com/mixhabits. That's sonicscoop.com/mixhabits, or my Mastering 101 workshop at sonicscoop.com/mastering101. Both of those are completely free. I hope you enjoy them. This has been Justin Coletti of Sonic Scoop. Thanks for hanging out with me once again. See you next time.